What defines Ohio? A place that dares to go first and never looks back. There's no slowing us down. In Ohio, we're powering America, discovering breakthroughs, driving the future, propelling tomorrow. At Jobs Ohio, our mission is clear. Strengthen job opportunities and empower Ohio's workforce. Ohio, our time is now. See Ohio's momentum at jobsohio.com/ohio's time.
What's up, baby? It's Bretzky, and I'm here to tell you that SpinQuest.com is giving out free sweeps coins. All you gotta do is purchase a $10 coin pack, and guess what? They're gonna give you the coins from a $30 coin pack. That lets you play all your favorite games like Blackjack, Wanted, Dead or Wild, and we're talking real cash prizes, baby. SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Welcome back, friends. Yeah, glad you came by. It's a very special night tonight. Yeah! And no, not because it's National Ugly Christmas Sweater Day. It's because it's National Drew Promotes His New Audiobook Night. Chester, that's the ugliest damn Christmas sweater I've ever seen. Good work, pal. It's no holiday for the guy he took that off of. Come on in, friend. So tonight, we welcome the illustrious Adam Howe to the fold. The man who actually won that Stephen King on writing contest. And more notable still, he's got a hell of a new audiobook out. We'll discuss that in a bit. So smoke 'em if you got 'em and drink those glasses to the bottom, y'all. Cause old Drew Blood has a tale to tell. Rigamarole.
Howdy. You're listening to the standard edition of this program. If you'd like to show your support and enjoy ad-free versions of this and all our other episodes, visit simplyscarypodcast.com and click Patrons in the upper menu and sign up today. You'll get instant access to the whole kit and caboodle, including millions of tales from our audio archives dating back to 2012. Ready to throw your hat in the ring, authors? Send your stories to drewbloodhorror@gmail.com. If selected, shit, you'll get the full treatment.
For our first story tonight, we do a little shopping with our new pal Donnie. Turns out he's short on cash and at the end of his proverbial rope. But what if the other guy is also? So without further delay, I give you, from author Adam Howe, Clean Up on Aisle 3. Donnie sat in his beat-to-shit Pinto with the heater on full, huddling for warmth beneath the driver's side window that wouldn't quite shut. An icy wind whipped through the half-inch gap, numbing his hand as he checked his 38 special. He shoved the piece in his coat pocket and then stared across the street at the mini-mart, the neon quick-stop sign flashing red and blue in the night. It was the only store on the downtown strip still open this late. All the other stores had their shutters lowered, tagged with graffiti like tribal markings. Through the window, he saw the scrawny Arab storekeeper perched behind the counter reading a magazine. Donnie hadn't seen any customers since he pulled up outside. The guy was alone in there, just him and the cash register. Checking his reflection in the rear view, Donnie gave a pained sigh. He looked and felt like stepped on shit, sick with whatever bug was going around. Last thing he needed was to be pulling a job, but he was already late on this week's vig. He didn't pay what he owed, and the flu would be the least of his problems. He reached across the car to pop open the glove compartment, fished out his lucky ski mask. Black wool trimmed with red around the eyes and mouth. Dusting off the mask, he yanked it down over his head and then rolled it back up in a beanie hat. Donnie honked his nose in a snot rag, stuffed a hanky in his pocket with the piece, pumped himself up with a few wheezy breaths, and then he clambered from the Pinto and started crossing the street to the quick stop. The bell above the door tinkled as he entered. The cramped little store was divided into three narrow aisles, the shells stockpiled like a doomsday prepper's bunker. Loud ethnic music was playing, trumpets and drums and off-key warbling like a cat being castrated. The storekeeper glanced up from his magazine, leathery olive skin and a gray goatee beard, his bald pate polished to a gleaming shine. He wore a white collarless shirt and a ratty old cardigan. The guy reminded Donnie of the limey actor who went blackface to play Gandhi. On the counter beside him, a no checks, no credit sign was taped to the back of the register. Donnie cut a glance at the security camera above the cigarette rack. The very latest model, from the 90s. If the damn thing even worked, the playback would be a blizzard of static. It was probably just for show to scare off amateurs. Not taking any chances, Donnie bowed his head and shielded his mug from the camera's gaze as he sloped to the beer cooler opposite the counter. At the front of the store was a discount DVD bin and a half-price arsenal of fireworks for New Year's, the boxes all stacked in a pyramid like one giant rocket. Donnie glanced down the three aisles for customers or other employees. He didn't see anyone, just a lonely-looking mop and bucket in aisle two. The storekeeper was clearly no neat freak. The shelves were dusty, the goods caked in grime. The place could have used a good airing. It reeked worse than Donnie's flea pit apartment, and that was smelling something. At the back of the store was the liquor display, a few ragged cobwebs clinging to the bottles, and a steel door marked Staff Only. Donnie couldn't hear anything behind the door, but it was hard to tell over the blaring music. Maybe the storekeeper lived back there with his wife and their little kids. The hell with it. He'd be gone before anyone even knew it. With his back to the storekeeper, Donnie tugged his lucky ski mask down over his face and then reeled towards the counter, whipping the .38 from his pocket.
Okay, asshole!
He shouted above the music.
You know what this is!
The storekeeper glanced up from his magazine as if Donnie had only asked him to price check an item. Seeing the revolver in Donnie's fist, the man's dark eyes narrowed. He rose slowly from his stool, raising his hands. Unlike Donnie's, they were steady as a rock. The guy looked so calm, Donnie wondered if he even spoke English. Then he said, with a heavy accent,
"Oh yes, my friend. I know what this is."
"Just open the register and give me the money. You won't get hurt."
The storekeeper gave a curt nod, well-versed in armed robbery etiquette. Lowering one hand, he reached slowly towards the cash register and pressed the button. And suddenly, he wasn't there.
What?
Donnie blinked in surprise.
Huh?
The fucking guy just disappeared. Peering over the counter, Donnie saw a trap door. The door still swinging where the storekeeper had dropped down into the basement onto a mattress. Splayed out on his back, the man glared up at Donnie with a hateful grin. Then he slashed a finger across his throat before rolling off the mattress and out of sight.
"The fuck?"
Donnie muttered. And then steel shutters crashed down over the front door and window. The power went out, the store went black, and the music and even the hum of the refrigerator shut off, entombing the place in sudden silence. It took a moment for Donnie's eyes to adjust to the gloom. He rolled his ski mask back up into a beanie, stood gaping at the shutters in disbelief. He had never seen shutters inside a store before. He banged his fist against the shutters, thick steel, like the treads of a tank. Donnie lashed out with his boot until his knee buckled, and he hobbled back in pain. Feeling his skin crawl, he glanced up at the winking red light of the security camera above the cigarette rack, shuddering as he pictured the storekeeper silently watching him. He scurried behind the counter, ignoring the register, the cash now forgotten. Careful not to fall through the open trap, Donnie searched beneath the counter for a button or something to raise the shutters. What the hell had the storekeeper pressed to drop the trap door? Donnie couldn't even find a panic button. And now that he thought of it, why wasn't any alarm sounding? Crouching warily above the open trap, he peered down into the dingy basement. All he could see was the mattress where the storekeeper had landed.
Hey!
Donnie shouted down, panic in his voice.
Open these fucking shutters!
He could hear the storekeeper cursing in Arabic, like a camel clearing phlegm from its throat. The guy sounded pissed, like this wasn't the first time his store had been held up, but by Allah, it would be the last. Then came the unmistakable shick-shuck of a pump shotgun being racked. Donnie darted back from the open trap. That's why there wasn't any alarm. The guy planned to take care of business himself. Donnie looked despairingly at his .38. He never worked with a loaded gun. If the threat of being shot wasn't enough, then the job wasn't worth it. Better to walk away, find some other place to stick up. Ideally with an owner who had enough sense to do what they were told when you stuck a gun in their face. Until now, he thought he was being smart. Shoving the useless fucking gun back into his coat, Donnie scuttled down the aisles toward the staff-only door at the back of the store. If it was locked, he was screwed. He'd have to take his licks and beg the storekeeper not to kill him. He was almost at the door when he heard the jangle of keys on the other side.
Oh, shit.
Donnie dove into aisle one and crouched low behind the shelves, cloaking himself in the shadows as the door clattered open. The storekeeper emerged from the back room, clutching a shotgun bigger than he was. He paused to yank the door shut behind him, locking it from a key hoop clipped to his belt. There was something funny looking about him. In the gloom, it was hard to tell exactly what. Then the storekeeper turned his head, and Donnie thought he'd lost his mind. A giant frog was sweeping the shotgun left to right across the aisles. Donnie tried to blink away the nightmare. Then he realized the storekeeper was wearing some kind of mask. No, not a mask. Night vision goggles. The lenses protruding from his head like bulbous amphibian eyes. Tiny jewels of sweat glittered on the Arab's scalp. He began to sidestep slowly along the end of the aisles, his cheap leather shoes squeaking as he crabbed along. The shotgun steady in his hands as he moved methodically towards aisle one, towards Donnie, crouching in the shadows. Panicking, Donnie snatched a jar of coffee from the shelf in front of him and then lobbed it over the aisles like a grenade. Glass shattered as it exploded on the far side of the store. The storekeeper pivoted with the squeal of his squeaky shoes. The shotgun roared, the blast punching a hole through the aisles and scattering stock, the deafening noise drowning out Donnie's scream. This guy wasn't fucking around. He wasn't going to rough him up or make a citizen's arrest. Donnie wasn't talking his way out of this shit. There'd been no hesitation as the storekeeper turned and fired. That blast was intended to cut him in half. The man meant to kill him. This should have been a quick dollar stick-up. Donnie wasn't going to play cat and mouse with a shotgun-toting maniac. Let the cops deal with this crazy bastard. He'd take the arrest if it meant he left the quick stop alive. He dug in his coat for his cell phone.
Shit.
No signal bars on the display. He waved the phone about frantically, searching for a signal.
Come on.
Had the shutters caused some kind of blackout? He raised the phone towards the ceiling.
Come on.
A single signal bar flickered weakly. He listened out for the storekeeper. On the far side of the store, he heard Arabic cursing as the man found the shattered coffee jar and realized he had been duped. The storekeeper racked his shotgun and started back along the aisles, his shoes squeaking urgently. Donnie monkeyed up the shelves in front of him. The flimsy wooden shelving board sagged beneath his weight. His ears were still ringing from the shotgun blast. He could only hope that the storekeeper had also been deafened, that the guy didn't hear him as Donnie slid on the top of the shelving unit, disturbing a thick layer of dust that swirled around him in a cloud that prickled his fluey nose. The storekeeper sprang into the aisle directly below him. When he saw the aisle was empty, the Arab muttered a curse, lowering the shotgun and then adjusted the sweaty strap of his night goggles. He was breathing hard, maybe even excited, enjoying the thrill of the hunt. He started stalking down the aisle towards the front of the store. Flattened on top of the shelving unit, Donnie didn't dare move, holding his breath and fighting an almost overwhelming urge to sneeze. From the corner of his eye, he watched as the storekeeper crept along the aisle below him. The man left his line of sight, but Donnie was still able to track him by his squeaky shoe. He checked his cell phone again and gave a silent prayer of thanks when he saw there were now two signal bars on the display. But before he could dial 911, he inhaled another thick cloud of dust that set his nose ablaze. The Arab turned and fired without hesitation, the shotgun belching fire. Donnie sprang from the shelving unit, shredded cereal boxes exploding behind him, a shower of Kellogg's raining over the store. Slamming into the next shelving unit, he crashed down into aisle two, landing heavily on his back next to the mop bucket, his cell phone shattering on the floor beside him. The storekeeper racked his shotgun and charged up the aisle towards him. Wolfing for breath, Donnie could only flail his legs, kicking over the mop bucket. Sludgy gray water spewed across the floor. The storekeeper slid on the muck like an Arabic Chevy Chase. He thudded to the floor and fired another deafening blast, plaster raining down from the ceiling. Before the man could recover, Donnie scrambled to the nearest shelving unit. He slithered across the bottom shelf, clawing through a crinkling wall of potato chip bags, emerging into aisle three. Bracing himself against the deep freeze refrigerator chest, he hauled himself up onto rubbery legs, sucking for breath. Through the gaps in the shelves, he could see the storekeeper in the center aisle, wobbling to his feet like a prize fighter trying to beat the ref's count. Racking the shotgun with a grunt, the Arab began limping around the aisle after Donnie, careful not to slip on the sludge-slick floor, one hand clutching at the shelves for balance. Donnie was still slumped against the deep freeze, trying to catch his breath. The small of his back was screaming with pain where he had landed on it. Before the storekeeper rounded the aisles and spotted him, Donnie hauled up the lid of the deep freeze. Hardly thinking about what he was doing, he slid inside the chest and buried himself among the frozen food packages.
You know what? It sucks to be bored. But when I get on my phone and play real casino games on SpinQuest.com, the time flies by. That two-hour wait at the DMV seems like 10 minutes. Play your favorite slots, live blackjack, live craps, with a live dealer. New players' $30 coin packs are on sale for 10 bucks. Play SpinQuest.com and you'll never be bored again.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
As he cowered inside the icy coffin, peering up in terror through the frosted glass, listening to the storekeeper's shoes squeak closer, it occurred to Donnie that as far as dumb fucking ideas went, this was right up there alongside robbing a store with an unloaded gun. The storekeeper paused next to the deep freeze. Wheezing for breath, he steadied himself against the refrigerator chest. Donnie stifled a scream as a hand thudded down on the glass lid. For a moment, it seemed like the man was staring right down at him. Then he dragged his hand from the glass to wipe the sweat off his forehead. Frowning, the Arab glanced back down the aisle, maybe fearing his prey had circled behind him. Then he moved on to the back of the store. Donnie waited until he heard the distant jangle of keys as the storekeeper checked whether the staff-only door was locked. Then he palmed up the glass door of the deep freeze and eased himself out, crouching down beside the refrigerator and listening intently. It sounded like the guy was doing another lap of the store. This time, Donnie would be waiting for the crazy fuck. He scuttled to the liquor display at the back of the store. Forced to squint in the gloom, Donnie scanned the shelves for fire water, saw a picture of Speedy Gonzalez on a dusty label, and grabbed a bottle of Arriba 100 proof tequila. Nodding to himself, he crouched behind the aisle two end shelf and then peeked around the corner, waiting for the storekeeper to appear at the front of the store. He unscrewed the bottle cap, wincing at the screech of twisted metal, but the storekeeper didn't seem to hear. Donnie listened to the guy's shoe squeaking as he continued his patrol of the store. Donnie necked a big swig from the bottle. for what he needed to do and for courage. He shuddered as the tequila burned through him. Snatching his snot rag from his pocket, he began stuffing it into the bottleneck until only a little cloth tongue poked out. Then he pulled his Zippo lighter from his pocket and thumbed the wheel. The storekeeper's shoes stopped in mid-squeak. The Zippo shook in Donnie's hand as he torched the snot rag fuse. The shotgun roared. A tower of Heinz cans exploded on the shelf above Donnie's head. Spaghetti sauce sprayed down over him, nearly snuffing out the flame. The storekeeper reloaded, feeding shells into the shotgun like a degenerate gambler playing the slots. Donnie mopped the spaghetti sauce from his eyes and then leapt out from cover. They faced each other like Old West gunfighters. A tin of beans rolled like tumbleweed across the aisle between them. The storekeeper saw the Molotov cocktail in Donnie's hands. His mouth dropped open in shock. He started raising the shotgun. Donnie Hail Mary'd the burning bottle, and then he watched in horror as it sailed harmlessly over the storekeeper's head. The bottle shattered against the steel shutters behind him and burst into flames. The storekeeper stood silhouetted before a wall of fire like a frog-headed demon from hell. Oblivious to the danger behind him, the storekeeper sneered at Donnie as he aimed a shotgun, his finger teasing the trigger, as flames started licking the fireworks display. There was a blinding white flash, and then the fireworks boomed like Hiroshima. Instantly, the storekeeper became a human fireball, the blast blowing him off his feet and hurling him up the aisles like a missile. He sailed straight past Donnie and crashed into the staff-only door, thudding to the floor like a piece of barbecue you toss to the dog. The front of the store was now an inferno. Rockets ignited and screeched from the flames, setting shelves ablaze, the sound deafening inside the steel-shuttered store. The place was fast becoming a death trap. Donnie crouched beside the charred storekeeper. He took off his coat and smothered the flames of the man's burning cardigan. Wrestling the key hoop from his belt, Donnie juggled the red-hot keys, yelping as they scorched his palms. Wrapping his coat around his hand like an oven glove, he unlocked the staff-only door to reveal another locked door marked Delivery and stairs leading down to the basement. Donnie knelt in front of the second door and sorted through the jumble of keys, trying to find the key that would fit the lock. Something squeaked behind him. Glancing over his shoulder, he saw the storekeeper staggering to his feet. His face was flame-grilled hamburger. The night goggles were melted onto his head like devil horns. He propped himself up in the doorway, smoke coiling from the scorched rags of his cardigan. Before Donnie could stand, the Arab lunged at him, slamming the shotgun across his throat, pinning him against the door. The fire had fused the shotgun to his hands. The melted flesh of his fingers was webbed across the stock as he crushed Donnie's larynx. Choking, Donnie grappled the shotgun and shoved the guy back. They stumbled across the landing, tumbling down the stone steps and thudding onto the concrete floor of the basement. Landing on top of Donnie, the storekeeper jammed the shotgun back across his throat and pressed down with all his weight. Donnie spluttered and bucked, the key hoop in his hand jangling wildly as he flailed at the man's face, before he slammed a long mortise key through the left lens of the Arab's night goggles, driving it deep into the eye socket. He then wrenched the key in the man's eyeball like he was forcing open a rusty lock. The storekeeper gave a hog-like squeal. His head jerked back, the keys dangling from his face like bloody jewelry. Yolky yellow gunk gushed from the shattered lens of his goggles, spraying across Donnie's face. Gagging, Donnie hammered the heel of his hand against the key, burying it deeper in the Arab's eye. The storekeeper shrieked, lurching to his feet and staggering blindly about the basement. Donnie scrabbled back across the floor, spitting eyeball fluid and heaving for breath. the Arab crashed against a stock shelf, cans and jars clattering and smashing on the floor around him. He reached up to remove the keys from his eye before realizing he couldn't, not with the shotgun welded to his hands. His arms twitched pathetically, once, twice. Then all the fight seemed to drain right out of him. His body sagged, and he slumped down on a camp bed parked against the cinder block wall, the spring squealing like his squeaky shoes. Huddled on the bed, the man glowered at Donnie with his one good eye, the other a ruined hollow of red and yellow slime. He slowly raised his left knee. Donnie watched in disbelief as the man planted the left sole of his shoe against the length of the shotgun and sucked a few shallow breaths before he flexed his leg and the melted flesh of his palms ripped free from the stock with a sound like Velcro tearing. The shotgun clattered to the floor in front of him, but he was too weak to reach for it. With raw and bloody hands, the Arab grasped the hoop of keys dangling from his face. Donnie covered his mouth with his hand, nearly begged the guy to stop, but he couldn't look away. The Arab yanked on the key hoop. The key ripped from his eye socket with a wet popping sound. He gave a yelp and fainted dead away, flopping back on the camp bed with the keys clutched tightly in his fist. Donnie almost fainted himself. His head was spinning as he staggered to his feet. He peeled off the ski mask and covered his nose and mouth to keep from choking on the thick black smoke belching down into the basement through the open trap door above them. Fiery ash rained down onto the mattress. It wouldn't be long before the fire spread downstairs. Already the basement was baking like a pizza oven. He took a wary step towards the storekeeper, eyeing the keys clutched in the man's fist. It looked like the guy was out for the count. All it took was getting burned half to death, blasted into a wall, thrown down a staircase, and stabbed in the eye. But Donnie wasn't about to take any chances. This guy was like the fucking Terminator. He kicked the shotgun beyond the Arab's reach. It skidded across the floor and clanged against the legs of a workbench. Donnie paused when he noticed some kind of photo shrine on the wall above the workbench. The cluster of photos showed a young woman. The storekeeper's wife, Donnie figured. She was beautiful. Even in a burning building, Donnie could appreciate a piece of ass. And very pregnant. Beneath the shrine sat a chunky security monitor. But it wasn't showing the store go up in flames. Instead, it was hooked to an old VCR player, running a short loop of silent film. The grainy black and white footage was time-coded in the bottom corner, dated 6 years ago. It showed the storekeeper's pregnant wife as she stood in terror behind the shop counter. She was opening the cash register for a jittery punk wearing a stocking mask that smashed his features. He was clutching a pistol in a sideways gangster grip. The cash drawer slid open. The punk's pistol spat fire. The back of the woman's long hair flailed as her brain splattered the cigarette rack. Bloody cartons of smokes rained from the rack in a waterfall. The woman crumpled to the floor. Leaning over the counter, the punk raided the cash register, pocketing bills as he fled the store. The footage looped and played again, and again. Donnie looked at the cushioned chair parked in front of the monitor. The cushion cratered by the weight of the husband and the weight of the grief pressing down on him. How long had the storekeeper sat here? Hour after hour, day after day, watching again and again as his pregnant wife was gunned down by a two-bit stick-up man, a piece of shit like Donnie. Before the footage could loop and play again, Donnie switched off the monitor. He saw his reflection in the blank TV screen and was about to look away in shame, sickened at the sight of himself. Then something in the screen's reflection caught his eye, a sudden movement behind him. He wheeled around in time to see the storekeeper swinging a fire extinguisher by the hose like a mason chain. The metal butt of the fire extinguisher scythed across his jaw, smashing teeth and bone, and Donnie dropped like he had been shot, like the storekeeper's wife, out cold before he hit the deck. When he came to, Donnie found himself face down on the cracked concrete floor. His ankles and wrists were bound tightly with duct tape, hogtied behind him. He raised his throbbing head weakly off the floor. A rope of congealed blood drooled from his mouth, puddling like black treacle on the concrete. His vision blurred in and out of focus, but he could see that he was still in the basement. The room was fogged with smoke that was starting to clear. The fire upstairs had been extinguished. The storekeeper must have doused the flames while Donnie was unconscious. Donnie listened intently for the wail of EMS sirens outside. Surely someone must have reported World War III breaking out in the quick stop. But all he could hear was the sound of someone digging. A section of the basement's concrete floor had been broken, probably by the sledgehammer propped against the wall. A slab of stone levered up to reveal the dirt below. The storekeeper was using a shovel to dig a hole in the plot of earth, piling up the dirt beside the steel drum with a skull and crossbones symbol and a label marked Lie. The Arab's wounded hands were swathed in bandages. He grimaced in pain as he worked the shovel. Whenever the pain seemed too much to bear, he would glance at the security monitor on the workbench, watching the footage of his dying wife again, and summoning the strength to continue digging. When he was done, he climbed from the hole and loomed over Donnie. Donnie tried to beg, but his shattered jaw and blood-clogged mouth allowed only a pitiful, choked whimper. The Arab planted a foot on him, his shoe giving the last squeak Donnie would ever hear as he kicked him into the grave. Donnie landed on his back, his bound arms and legs twisted painfully beneath him with the impact. He watched in helpless terror as the shopkeeper began shoveling the dirt over him. The last thing he saw was what looked like another shrine on the wall directly above him. No photos this time. Donnie thought this one looked less like a shrine than a trophy wall. Nailed to the cinder blocks was a stocking mask, a bandana, and three ski masks, one of them black wool with red trim around the eyes and mouth. And not so lucky, after all. And that was Clean Up on Aisle 3 by author Adam Howe. A good reminder that the most dangerous man there is the man with nothing to lose. And you never do know who you're dealing with. Just something to consider when you're robbing your local convenience store. So, for our second segment tonight, we've got some shameless self-promotion. Just released on Amazon and Audible.com is Adam's latest audiobook, Tijuana Donkey Showdown, and it's a banger. And Adam, if you're listening to this, I'm not calling your book a sausage. In America, that just means it's good. Sausage is good too, but, well, I'm sure you understand. So without further delay, I give you Chapter 1 of Tijuana Donkey Showdown. Chapter 1. For a great Buick, call 555-7617. I first met Harry Muffet in the men's room at the Hen House, Walt Wiley's Titty Tonk in Bigelow Town, where some fella, looked like an orc from the Lord of the Rings movie, only not as pretty, was using Harry's head as a toilet plunger. The orc had Harry by the ankles, dunking him headfirst into the crapper like he was dipping a donut in his morning cup of joe. He dragged Harry's head from the bowl and granted him a gulp of air to prolong his misery. The orc clearly hadn't done him the courtesy of flushing the commode. Harry's face was freckled with the previous occupant's leavings, maybe the orc's, in which case this was a premeditated deal. Filth was spewing up over the rim of the bowl, spreading across the cracked tile floor of the men's room. I shook my head and sighed, not needing three guesses to know who'd be cleaning up the mess. This was already shaping up to be a regular rare morning. The men's room door clattered shut behind me. The orc's head cranked around, and he glared at me, a tree stump of a man with a patchy red beard, like even his facial fuzz wanted off his ugly mug. He wore a sweat-stained shirt with a trucking company logo on the back, and his name was stitched across the breast, maybe so he wouldn't forget it. That name was Otis. Well, of course it was. In my experience, you can't reason with an Otis. They're ornery as hell. I stayed standing where I was at the entrance to the John, my new copy of Ring magazine tucked under my arm, and last night's microwave burrito, which had seemed like a swell idea at the time, bolting through my bowels like a fugitive fleeing for the border. I fidgeted from foot to foot. "You fellas gonna be long?" Because the men's room at the hen house had just one commode, not counting the sink, although on rowdy weekends a lot of fellas did count it. Harry came up for air and spluttered.
"What the hell you think's going on here?"
"I wouldn't want to jump to conclusions."
"And do I look like a willing participant in this?"
On consideration, I had to admit he didn't.
"And you work here, right?"
I glanced down at the black t-shirt I was wearing. Staff was printed across the chest, except most of the A had rubbed off in the wash, so it looked more like it read stiff. My boss, Walt Wiley, for my sins he was also my best friend, thought that was hysterical and refused to spring for a new shirt. I looked back at Harry and nodded reluctantly.
"So do something."
Otis glanced between Harry and me.
"This piece is shit a friend of yours?"
Harry started telling them how we were lifelong buddies, willing to die for each other. Unable to hear over Harry's yammering, Otis shoved his head back down into the toilet bowl. Harry's gargling cries echoed through the men's room. "Nope," I said to Otis, "but I am the head bouncer here." I couldn't resist using the trumped-up job title Walt had given me instead of a raise. Except Otis called me on it.
"There's other bouncers in this dive?"
"The point is," I said, "I can't allow you to drown the man in our commode." Not least because I was likely to contaminate the crime scene when I took a dump in it directly afterwards. Otis's face crumpled in disappointment, like he couldn't believe what this country was coming to. That a man was no longer free to drown someone in a strip club toilet. Thanks, Obama.
"Well, you don't understand, mister. This horn-swoggling son of a bitch sold my sister a death trap on wheels. He damn near killed her."
Harry came up for air and protested.
"I can't be held responsible once the car leaves the lot."
"She wasn't 50 yards off the lot when the brakes failed," Otis said. "She nearly went under a truck."
"Well,"
Harry said with a sheepish chuckle,
"shit happens."
Which was an unfortunate choice of words, because down he went again. The next time Otis led Harry up for air, I canted my head like an art critic and took a closer look at him. And I suddenly recognized his face, soiled though it was, from the advertising billboards around town. The sign said, "Harry's Pre-Owned American Auto." Buying a new pre-owned? You'll be happy as Larry you bought from Harry. In the billboards, Harry was holding up a set of car keys, grinning like a fisherman with the catch of the day. Behind him was a fleet of gleaming luxury cars that looked nothing like the decrepit beaters I saw on display whenever I passed his dealership. He was wearing the used car salesman's uniform of a check sports jacket and slacks with the stars and stripes tie. He boasted a magnificent bouffant of hair and a mustache like Tom Selleck's in Magnum, if Magnum lost his private eye license due to conduct unbecoming and went to hell in a bourbon bottle. Given the ubiquity of the billboards around town and the late-night TV commercials that aired on local cable,
Harry Muffet was something like a celebrity in Bigelow. I made the mistake of saying, "Hey, I know you." Harry clutched at my words like a drowning man clinging to flotsam.
"That's right, Reggie. You do. Of course you do. Help me, please."
I wasn't overly surprised that Harry knew my name. I was something of a local celebrity myself. Even Otis narrowed his eyes, sized me up and down.
"Reggie Levine?"
Once upon a time, I was a prize fighter. I could have been a contender, until the day I fought Boar Hog Brennan for the light heavyweight state title, and he damn near beat me to death. Years later, when it was of scant consolation, I discovered he'd cheated in our match, but that's another story. More recently and memorably, my claim to fame was what most folks in town called the Skunk Ape thing. A couple of years ago, a creature believed to be the mythical Bigelow Skunk Ape, a backwoods Bigfoot with B.O., abducted our high school football mascot, Boogaloo Baboon, plus the man inside the monkey suit, Ned Pratt. I found myself among the posse who set off into the sticks on a rescue mission, along with Eliza Tuttle, who used to dance topless at the hen house, and who now acts, often topless, in Hollywood B-pictures. Eliza's boyfriend, the late Lester Swash, and self-proclaimed skunk ape hunter Jameson T. Salisbury. Now, it turned out the skunk ape wasn't no skunk ape. It was just a big-ass orangutan called Mofo. Unfortunately for us, Mofo was bad-tempered and randy as a goat with two peckers. Poor Ned bore the brunt of his lust. To make matters worse, Mofo was also a member of the Damn Dirty Apes Motorcycle Club. The apes were cooking crystal meth out at Herb Planter's old hog farm and were not best pleased when we stumbled across their operation. Needless to say, things went foobar right quick. Eliza, Ned, and me were lucky to escape with our lives. Salisbury and Lester weren't so fortunate. Probably that sounds a little strange to you. Well, no shit. I was there, and I still struggle to believe it really happened. Maybe you saw the Hollywood movie they made? Damn Dirty Apes. Swept the board at the Razzies last year. Eliza debuted as herself in the movie and did a pretty fair job of it. Me? I've got a mug that'd break a radio. Nicolas Cage played yours truly, sporting a mullet that made his Con Air do seem conservative, even though I haven't styled my hair like that since the 90s. But who in the hell am I to argue with the artistic choices of Nicolas Cage? The man's an icon. Ever since the movie was released, people had started visiting the hen house to hear me tell the story in person, or to ask me questions about Nicolas Cage, who I never met, so they'd always leave grumbling and disappointed. Stranger still were the folks who'd started bringing me their problems to solve, like I was some kind of one-man A-team who could help them. But worst of all were the scalp hunters, the badasses who wanted to test their mettle by dancing a few rounds with the skunk ape slayer, Reggie Levine. It looked like Otis was the latest of these knuckleheads, just bigger and uglier than usual. He stomped from the toilet stall like a troll from his cave. He was still clutching Harry by the ankle, one-handed no less, a show of brute strength that hardly filled me with joy at the prospect of going toe-to-toe with him.
"I heard of you," Otis sneered. "Mr. So-called Skunk Ape Slayer."
With a grunt, he flung Harry clear the length of the men's room. Harry crashed against the condom dispenser and thudded to the floor. A rain of rubbers ejaculated from the machine. Novelty rubbers, I should add, because for most of the patrons at the hen house, getting laid was indeed a novelty.
"We're selling fantasy here," Walt liked to say.
Otis marched towards me, chinking his neck and bawling ham hock fists.
"I'd like to see you beat on me like you beat on that orangutan," he said.
Did I mention that those damn dirty apes made me box Mofo the orangutan? True story. "I don't want no trouble here," I said. "All I want is a crap." Otis loosened my bowels with a left hook to the gut, and I filled my shorts with liquidized burrito. I managed to wheeze,
"God damn it."
Then he grabbed the front of my shirt and hoisted me up into the air. The top of my skull cracked the ceiling light with a crunch of plastic. The light bulb started spazzing, turning the men's room into the world's seediest discotheque.
Still clutching my copy of Ring magazine, I swatted Otis over the head with it, like I was trying to housebreak a puppy. That didn't do much else except piss him off, so I jabbed him in the eye with the rolled-up end. Now he was really mad. He let out a roar and pitched me across the room like he was trying to beat the record he'd set hurling Harry. I crashed through the flimsy wooden wall of the toilet stall, reducing years of historic graffiti to kindling. On hands and knees inside the buckled stall, I clutched a crapper and tried to steady myself. But before I could clamber to my feet, Otis landed on my back like Hulk Hogan leaping down from the turnbuckle. The breath woofed from my lungs. Otis gripped me by the hair and started shoving my head down towards the shit-choked toilet bowl. Snatching the porcelain lid from the toilet top, I swung the slab back over my shoulder and smashed a heavy tablet in two across Otis's forehead. Otis let out a grunt. His hands relaxed on the back of my neck. Squirming free from his grip, I scrambled across the stall away from him, wedging myself between the commode and the wall, like someone seeking shelter during an earthquake. Otis was out on his feet, teetering ominously. His eyeballs rolled up wide in his skull. Blood streamed from the gash in his forehead where I'd brained him with the cistern slab. He dropped to one knee like he was about to propose. Then, instead of popping the question, he toppled forwards, his bulk crashing down on the toilet bowl and shattering the porcelain to rubble. A tsunami of sewage flooded across the floor, drenching me in a stinking spray of brown and yellow filth. But, thank God, at least Otis was done for.
Forget whatever plans you have this weekend because you're staying at home and playing on SpinQuest. And there's never been a better time to sign up than right now. New users get $30 coin packs for just $10. All the table games you love with hundreds of slot games and real cash prizes. That's at SpinQuest.com. SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
I glanced across the men's room expecting to see Harry cowering beneath the condom dispenser, grateful for me having saved his life. But he was gone. The sneaky son of a bitch must have vamoosed while I was tussling with Otis. I leaned against the wall and caught my breath, not to mention a ferocious whiff of ripe human waste. Otis was splayed face down in a lake of piss. I didn't have the heart to just leave him to drown, so I rolled him onto his back. Okay, so I kicked him onto his back. Hard. He deserved that much. Surveying the flooded floor, I spotted a leather wallet propped up against a turd. It must have fallen from Harry's pocket while Otis was shaking him upside down. The wallet, I mean, not the turd. I fetched the wallet from the floor and tossed it in the sink and ran the faucet to clean it some. I'd return it to its owner with a few choice words. My new Ring magazine was beyond salvage, reduced to mulch, and that really pissed me off, because I'd had to order it special from the store in town and there was no telling how long I'd be waiting for a replacement. I grabbed Otis by his ankles and started yoking him from the men's room. 2. The hen house was much as I'd left it when I went to take a crap. In fact, the place had hardly changed in the couple years since the skunk ape thing. Same slab of oak bar fringed with old Christmas lights, same shrine of dusty liquor bottles behind it, same butcher block tables and chairs, same shadowy booths and slashed vinyl seats, same old Lou, huddled in the end of the runway stage like a seedy off-Broadway theater director, tithing the dancing gals from his pile of palm clammy singles. Same old Marlene, the hen house's sumo-sized dancing queen, working the stage in her G-string and pasties, spinning her tassels like Chinook rotor blades. Same cigarette-scarred pool table. Same Smokey and the Bandit pinball machine. I'd lost my high score to another pinball wizard, but was determined to claw it back, no matter how many quarters it cost me. The old rotary phone in the telephone kiosk had been repaired, but cell phones had been invented during the time it was out of service. Walt Wiley, the owner of the hen house, was holding court behind the bar.
"Mark my words," he proclaimed. "When the cops catch this backseat strangler son of a bitch, he'll be a Mexican."
The usual barflies were lining the oak slab like crows along a telephone wire, hanging on Walt's every word in the forlorn hope of a free shot. On the wall behind the bar was the framed yellow and news cutting commemorating my fight with Boar Hog Brennan. Bigelow Boy Brutalized in Prize Fight. Walt had since added more news cuttings about the skunk ape thing, for the tourists, he claimed, plus the postcards we'd occasionally received from Eliza out in Hollywood. There was even a framed poster from the Damn Dirty Apes movie. It was signed in a shaky hand, to my good friend Walt, Nick. Walt had, of course, signed the poster himself, which was why Nick Cage had misspelled his name and then sworn me to secrecy. Other than that, yep, same old hen house, all right, and same old Reggie Levine, neck deep in shit, only literally this time. 3. My ankle dragged Otis from the men's room, smearing sewage across the floor in our wake as I lugged him to the door. Walt took one look at me, and he must have remembered the funniest joke he had ever heard, because he started slapping the bar slab and laughing his ass off.
"Toilet humor," he said. "Can't beat it."
He said to the barflies,
"Take a picture on your phone, would you, someone?"
Great, I thought. A new addition to my wall of shame.
"Go take a look at the men's room," I said to Walt. "Let's see how you like toilet humor then."
I dragged Otis outside, left him in the parking lot to wake up and hobble home. He could count himself lucky I didn't call our local lawman, Constable Randy Ray Gooch, although, frankly, the fewer people saw me looking like this, the better. I went back inside, dripping on the wipe-your-feet welcome mat. Walt was still snickering.
"You see a used car salesman go running past?" I asked him. "Covered in shit? Guilty look on his face for leaving me to get killed?"
Walt considered for a moment.
Apart from the guilty look, you must mean Harry Muffet.
"Walt," I said, "I'm going to need to take a personal day."
"You asking or telling me?"
"You really want me working, looking, and smelling like this?" I could tell he was tempted to keep me around, if only to bust my chops. But in the end, the stench won out.
"See you bright and early tomorrow, champ."
Before I could leave, he called out,
"Reggie, wait."
I turned back around and was blinded by a camera flash. When my vision returned, Walt was grinning at the photo he had taken on a camera phone.
"Oh, yeah,"
he said.
"That's a keeper."
I fetched a sheet of tarp from the bed of my truck, spread it across the seats like a dog blanket, and then I drove home to change with the windows wide open and my head hanging out like Rover on a road trip. With the money I got for the movie rights to my story, not as much as you might think, I put a deposit on a nice little house in a goodish part of town. Figured I'd been living in my crummy apartment above the thrift store long enough. I also treated myself to the new secondhand Ford, thankfully from one of Harry Muffet's competitors, so it still ran. The rest of the money I'd given to Walt to invest on my behalf, if only to stop him nagging me. Walt fancied himself as Bigelow's answer to Donald Trump, and politically speaking, he wasn't far wrong. Walt had talked a great game about how he was going to turn my little nest egg into a fortune, but it turned out that's all it was. Talk. He promptly lost a lot to a Nigerian fishing scam. So, thanks to Walt, I lost all my movie money and forfeited the deposit I'd put on the house. A nice young couple lives there now. They've just had their first child, a little boy. Sometimes I'll drive past the place, not in a creepy way, I hope, and wonder what might have been. Long story short, I was still living in the same old flop house above the thrift store. I parked in the spot outside the thrift store that the owner, Mrs. Gorin, reserved for me. Mrs. Gorin was a kind-hearted bird whose innate need to mother matched my own to be mothered. We got along swell. She had put aside for me the men's adventure novels people donated to the store, as well as any hand-me-down duds she thought might flatter me more than my regular white trash chic wardrobe. All she asked in return was I occasionally help out in the store with any heavy lifting, which these days was as close to a workout as I got. For some time now, Mrs. Gorin had been threatening to set me up with her niece from Ayersville, which was a dubious proposition, See, I'd already met her nephew. And not to be unkind, but if his sister looked like him, the gal was likely to be less in oil painting than Neanderthal cave art. Now, you could make a solid argument that I had no right being picky. I've got a mug you wouldn't wish on a warthog. But the truth of the matter was that my heart belonged to another. She didn't want it, of course, and sometimes I'd wonder if Cupid's aim was off, considering how unobtainable the objects of my affections were. But it was hers all the same. Shelby Boone was the Newtown veterinarian. She had taken over the practice from Edgar Dubrow after the Bigelow Bugle exposed Dubrow's involvement in a neo-Nazi dogfighting racket, and he was struck off the veterinary register. Shelby had the kind of big brown eyes Van Morrison must have been singing about, a tomboyish crop of raven black hair, and cute little dimples in her cheeks and chin. Nor had it escaped my attention that there was one humdinger of a body beneath the practical shirt and pants she wore. Coming from a guy who works in the strip club, there's no higher compliment, as I told her when we first met. It would be an understatement to say Shelby was unimpressed by that comment, or the rumors I had killed not just an orangutan, but also a bear cub. As I climbed from the truck, caked in human filth and reeking of ditto, with the sheet of shitty tarpaulin glued to the seat of my pants like an errant scrap of toilet paper, Shelby emerged from the thrift store, where she'd been checking up on Mrs. Gorin's cat, Bootsy, after his recent operation. Shelby saw me and stopped in her tracks. I froze, hoping maybe if I didn't move she wouldn't see me, like a T-Rex. Then the wind changed direction. She made a kind of gagging noise, and I knew the game was up. I raked my hand through my hair in a futile effort to make myself look presentable. "Morning, Doc." Powdered excrement flaked like brown dandruff from my crap-caked locks. Shelby shuddered in disgust. Inside the store, I caught Mrs. Gorin shaking her head in despair. I guessed I'd probably blown it with her niece now, too. "Long story," I said to Shelby.
"I don't want to hear it,"
she said, backing away from me. "Gotcha." Feeling like I'd been kicked in the heart, I squelched past her to the outside stairs leading up to my flop house. 5. "You're expecting the Ritz, right? Sorry to disappoint you. Unless you envisioned the Ritz cracker box, in which case, yeah, the place was about that size. It was a combination living-slash-bedroom-slash-kitchen kind of deal, with an ensuite bathroom. Kind of one big room, really, only not so big. But I made it my own and decorated the place with empty takeout cartons and crushed beer cans and pack-ratted piles of pulp books and Ring magazine back issues. A withered brown cactus plant clung to life on the windowsill. Above the unmade sofa bed was the poster from Rocky you'll find on the wall of every boxer's crib. I fetched a brewski from the icebox, glugging it down as I showered the shit off me, but I couldn't sluice away Shelby's look of disgust. Face it, Levine, you're just a broke-down strip club palooka, living in a shoebox above a thrift store. A classy broad like Shelby Boone would never look twice at a pug like you. Hell, you'd be lucky to land a date with Lorena Bobbitt. The shame of it was that I had actually had a second chance to get my shit together and make something of myself. Sure, after the skunk ape thing and the money from the movie, I'd made a half-assed attempt to better myself. I'd put that deposit on the house, even made some inquiries about opening my own boxing gym, thinking maybe I could help disadvantaged kids, which in Bigelow was most every kid in town. Help them stay out of trouble by beating hell out of each other. But it was all just a pipe dream, no different than Walt kidding himself, at my expense, that he was a Wall Street whiz. In the end, I'd been content just to sit on my ass at the hen house, pissing away my 15 minutes of fame until all I was left with were the familiar regrets and self-loathing. I couldn't shake the feeling that by giving Walt my money to invest, I'd subconsciously sabotage myself. What the hell was wrong with me? Did I just fear change? I showered for about an hour, avoided my reflection in the medicine cabinet mirror as I cinched a towel around my spare tire, fetched another cold one from the icebox, Then I went and slumped on the sofa bed, gazing up at that poster of Rocky and Adrian. Was it really 2 months to ask? Hearing faint ticking, I glanced at my watch on the upturned orange crate that served as my side table. The watch had been a gift from Nicolas Cage, thanking me for my contribution to the Damn Dirty Apes movie, and for being a good sport about how the movie had turned out. It had a snakeskin strap like the jacket Cage had worn in an earlier, more prestigious movie, the jacket that symbolized his individuality and his belief in personal freedom. Rules to live by. The face had a picture of the Bigelow skunk ape that gave me the willies whenever I checked the time. The beast's long arms formed the watch's hour and minute hands. Not to seem ungrateful, because the watch was pretty sweet, made sweeter by the fact that it had come from Nicolas Cage. But after everything I'd been through, sometimes I felt I deserved more than just a watch, ticking to remind me time was slipping away. Luckily, I hadn't worn the watch to work that morning. It was waterproof, but I doubted that extended to piss and shit proof. I checked the time and saw it was business hours. Harry Muffet's car dealership would still be open. Was I still mad enough with Muffet to pay him a visit? You're goddamn right I was. 6. Harry's pre-owned American Auto was located in the hazy gray area between the bad and worse sides of town. One look at Harry's fleet of cars and you could see why more people were buying foreign these days. The place was little more than an automobile graveyard. The chain-link security fence was probably to prevent folks from junking their own clunkers here. If that happened, I figured Harry would have just slapped a sales sticker on the piece of shit. Draped above the lot like patriotic cobwebs were ropes of red, white, and blue plastic pennants, snapping tackily in the breeze. The mess of ropes was connected to an ancient Airstream trailer that looked like a big rusty toaster. Moored to the trailer was a 20-foot-tall balloon man. The balloon man's likeness to Harry was unmistakable. He wore a checkered sports coat and slacks, even sported Harry's trademark mustache and shit-eaten grin. The giant balloon man was filled with helium. I knew this because every month or so, he'd mysteriously break free of his bonds and float above town like the Goodyear blimp. For Harry, it was great free advertising. I trucked down the wide central lane, bracketed by banks of used cars, and stopped outside the Airstream. The inflatable Harry loomed above me, grinning and swaying in the breeze, the mooring ropes creaking as he strained against his bonds like a chained King Kong. A bird had shit on the balloon giant's head and smeared Harry's grinning face with guano. Maybe another unsatisfied customer. The sign on the trailer door said office. The trailer was pitching and rocking like the coin-operated spaceship outside the laundromat in town, where the mamas parked their rugrats while they did laundry. Squeals and smutty laughter echoed from the trailer as it rock and rolled. Blue balls were the least I owed Muffet. I hammered on the door. The trailer abruptly stopped rocking and swayed to a standstill. I heard whispered voices and a frantic scramble for clothes. Then the trailer door swung open, and Harry appeared. He was beet red, panting for breath, tucking his shirt tails into his slacks. Artfully zipping his fly with his wedding ring hand, he raked his other hand through the sweaty corkscrews of his hair, and then gave his fringe a Bobby Kennedy flick. In the office behind him, I saw a pretty young woman I guessed was Harry's secretary. She was hastily rearranging her desk clutter and straightening her blouse, which she was wearing inside out with the label poking up like cow-licked hair. Apparently, I had knocked while Harry was in mid-sentence.
"And be sure to bring me those papers to sign the moment they arrive, Miss Clemens."
It might have been a more convincing performance if not for the bitchin' heat stink baking from the trailer, Miss Clemens' brassiere draped over her desk, and Muffet, angling his hips to hide his hard-on. He saw who I was and panic flashed across his face. Then he plastered a grin across his mug.
"Reggie! You made it!"
Like I was a long-lost war buddy. "No thanks to you," I said, and tossed his wallet at him. It bounced off his shirt and left a stain. Seems like I hadn't cleaned all the muck off it after all. I almost smiled. You left this behind when you ran out on me. Harry was crestfallen.
Ran out on you?
He said in disbelief.
Is that how it looked?
That's how it was. He chuckled at how I'd got this all ass backwards.
Reggie,
he said,
as God is my witness, nothing could be further from the truth.
He took a moment to invent the truth.
I had to race back to the office was all. Poor Miss Clemens here was holding the fort by her lonesome. I only stepped out for a quick bite to eat.
A beer and a lap dance must have been Muffet's idea of a power lunch.
When that ruffian attacked me. Without provocation, I might add.
Then it's not true what Otis said about his sister? He dismissed my pedantry with a wave of his hand.
Let's not dwell on that.
He leaned towards me and whispered.
Is he dead?
You mean Otis? Of course he's not dead. Harry looked disappointed. You think I'd just up and kill a man? I'm a bouncer, not a stone-cold killer.
The way I hear it, you have before. Killed, I mean.
That was different. That was self-defense.
Even the orangutan?
Especially the orangutan. Just then, a plump gray rat darted from the trailer, claws clicking on the asphalt as it scuttled towards me. It clamped itself to my ankle and started humping my foot furiously, like the world was about to end and it wanted to go out fucking. With a cry of disgust, I started shaking my leg like Chuck Berry doing the duck walk, but I couldn't dislodge the critter. Then I realized it wasn't a rat. No, that would be an insult to rats. It was a dog. The ugliest fucking dog I'd ever seen in my life. A Chinese crested terrier. I'm more of an American bulldog man myself, or a cat if my only other canine option is a Chinese crested terrier. The beast's hairless body was a sickly plucked pink, speckled with markings like liver spots. The straggly gray fur of its mane, tail, and booties had been groomed like a My Little Pony from Hell. It pumped away at my foot, emitting high-pitched yipping noises with each thrust. Its eyes narrowed to lusty slits. A stub of pink tongue poked between snaggly yellow fangs. I could feel a damp patch developing on my ankle. Harry chuckled, a little too indulgently for my liking.
Quit that, Gizmo!
He clawed the little beast from my foot and tucked it under his arm. The dog started angrily yipping at me as if I was a tease playing hard to get. Cute dog, I lied, frowning at the semen stain on my shoe. Gizmo?
Like the movie,
Harry said.
You know, don't feed him after midnight.
Looks like someone already has. He glanced at the ugly little monster squirming under his arm.
What can I say? It's my wife's dog. Sometimes I think she loves this damn mutt more than me.
Hard to believe. Actually, it was pretty easy. The dog's yipping was giving me a headache. Listen, Muffet.
Hey, call me Harry.
Muffet, I said, I just came to return your wallet.
A regular Boy Scout?
Not really. You'll find it's light. I reimbursed myself the cost of a new shirt and pants. The soiled shorts were gratis, but he didn't need to know that. Plus a copy of Ring Magazine. I grinned. That okay with you, Muffet? He peeked inside his empty wallet and winced.
Hell, it's the least I could do.
He almost sounded magnanimous, as if he had coughed up the dough himself. I said, and you can bet your ass Walt will be in touch with the bill for the damages. He paled.
Damages?
About a men's room worth, I said, and then I doffed the brim of an imaginary hat. Fuck you very much, Mr. Muffet. You have yourself a shitty day. I started back to my truck.
Reggie, wait!
I stopped, sighed, and slowly turned around.
I feel terrible about what happened,
he said.
Just plain terrible.
Yeah, well, I'm sure Miss Clemens will lend you a shoulder to cry on. He chuckled sheepishly and quickly changed tack.
You know, I followed your boxing career.
Is that a fact?
Oh, sure. The Bear Hug Brannigan fight.
Boar Hog Brannan.
Hell of a fight,
he said without skipping a beat. I figured the extent of his knowledge about my boxing career came from the news cutting on the wall of the hen house. You know I lost that one, right?
Well, sure. It was a close fight.
Not really, unless you count when he broke his hand on my head.
All the same, I could use a man like you.
For what? Protecting you against disgruntled customers?
No, nothing like that. What happened with Otis was an aberration.
I strongly doubted that, but against my better judgment, I said, what exactly did you have in mind?
And that was chapter one of Tijuana Donkey Showdown. If you'd like to hear more, you can...
Oh, may I?
Okay, Jeff.
Drew is, modest. You know, southern thing. But listen, you need this book. You know Drew, you know Adam. It's fantastic. You're gonna be laughing the whole time. And Drew gets half the royalties, right? So when you buy this book, you're helping him. And look at him. Look at you, Bubby. Have you been eating well? You're all skin and bone.
Jeff?
Yeah, bud?
Can you not pinch my cheeks?
Oh. Alright, I'll be in the booth then.
So, pick up Tijuana Donkey Showdown on Audible.com, narrated by yours truly. You won't be disappointed, I assure you. It's a quintessential breakfast sausage. A little about the author. Adam Howe writes the twisted fiction your mother warned you about. A British writer of fiction and screenplays, he lives in London with his partner, their daughter, and a hellhound named Gino. Writing as Garrett Adams, his short story Jumper was chosen by Stephen King as the winner of the International On Writing Contest and published in the paperback and Kindle editions of King's memoir. His fiction has appeared in places like Nightmare Magazine, Thug Lit, Mythic Delirium, and Year's Best Hardcore Horror. He's the author of Tijuana Donkey Showdown, Scapegoat with James Newman, two novella collections, Die Dog or Eat the Hatchet, and Black Cat Mojo, and the editor of the WrestleManiacs anthology. His latest novel is One Tough Bastard, a fist bump to the 80s 90s buddy action movies. In the pipeline, The Pollock, a 1930s grit-lit pulp, co-written with Joseph Hirsch. Stalk him at Facebook, Goodreads, and Twitter at Adam_G_Howe. So thank you, Adam. A blast working with you, friend. Looking forward to the next one.
And do old Drew Blood a favor, would you? Subscribe to his podcast wherever you do your listening and leave him a 5-star review and a kind word, even if you're listening on YouTube. He needs soldiers on all fronts to win this battle, and he appreciates it. To hear a premium ad-free edition of tonight's and all the other episodes, visit SimplyScaryPodcast.com today and click Patrons in the upper menu. You'll find yourself at ChillinTalesForDarkNights.com, where you can become a patron for as little as $5 per month and get access to their entire audio archive, all ad-free and available to download or stream. Thank you for your time and for supporting our sponsors. When you support our sponsors, you support this show. If you happen to use Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or YouTube, you can follow and subscribe to Chilling Tales for Dark Nights there, where you'll get all the latest updates and new releases and have the chance to interact with them each and every week. Oh, and you can find Drew Blood on Facebook and Instagram, and sometimes Twitter. The Drew Blood's Dark Tales podcast is accepting submissions, friend. If you've got a story or two you'd like to be featured on the show, send it to drewbloodhorror@gmail.com. If selected, you'll get the full treatment, 10 bananas.
Well, I'm afraid this is where we part ways, at least till next week. So grab a drink for the road, friend. And if you need something to listen to while you're out there, well, check the show notes. I'd like to take the time to say hello to a few new friends of the show. So, Michael Pohl out in Leicester, England. Chris Canico, a.k.a. Crumbs. You got a few on your chin, bud. And John McKenzie for hurting my feelings on Facebook this week. So, without further delay, Michael Pohl, Crumbs, and John McKenzie. May the wind be at your back, and may the road rise up to meet you. And if the wind's at your front and the road's not cooperating for the moment, just wait it out for a bit and go fuck yourselves. Especially you, Crumbs. Good night, y'all.
What defines Ohio? A place that dares to go first and never looks back. There's no slowing us down. In Ohio, we're powering America, discovering breakthroughs, driving the future, propelling tomorrow. At Jobs Ohio, our mission is clear. Strengthen job opportunities and empower Ohio's workforce. Ohio, our time is now. See Ohio's momentum at jobsohio.com/ohio's time.
Forget whatever plans you have this weekend because you're staying at home and playing on SpinQuest. And there's never been a better time to sign up than right now. New users get $30 coin packs for just $10. All the table games you love with hundreds of slot games and real cash prizes. That's at SpinQuest.com. SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.